That's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Flash, Washington. The White House announces Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
That the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
General Eisenhower informs me that the forces of Germany have surrendered to the United Nations.
I consider myself the luckiest man on the face of the earth.
One day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
Men will still say, this was our finest hour.
Hello and welcome to Speaking of History. My name is Eric Langhorst and today's date is June 27th, 2006, and I'm coming to you from Chicago at the Discovery Educator Network Midwest Regional Summer Institute, and this is podcast episode number 30. Today I have a treat for you. Yesterday, Will Richardson gave a great presentation on Web 2.0 tools in the classroom and how it's impacting education, and I was able to go ahead and podcast that. So I'm going to give that to you in its entirety. It's a rather long file. In the past, I've done some things where I've done two different files and split it up, but I think today I'm going to put it on just one file, so it might take you a little bit extra to download, but I think you'll really enjoy it. This would be a great podcast to stick with you in the car if you're going on vacation or if you're taking a walk. A lot of stuff for teachers to think about and really digest and try and get a handle on a lot of this new media that's coming out for education today. So I'm going to go ahead and get started and let you listen to Will Richardson. Also, if you're interested, Will just came out with a great new book. It's called Blogs, Wikis, Podcasts, and Other Powerful Web Tools for Classrooms. And I'll go ahead and also add that to your summer reading list. Great book, and give you some great tips on how to use these things in your classroom with your students. So without further ado, I'm going to go ahead and turn it over to Will and try and get some podcasts done today on what's happening at the Institute. Having a great time. Try and get some feedback from me from other participants on what they think of the Institute. So sit back and enjoy Will Richardson.
Thanks, Kristen. Thank you very much. Can you guys hear me in the back? Right, I'll yell as much as I can. I just want to tell you, it's always great to be in a room full of teachers. I keep thinking, if this was corporate America, what would this room look like, right? It'd be a whole bunch of people sitting in suits. There wouldn't be balloons. There wouldn't be any butterflies. There certainly wouldn't be any candy at the desk. And on top of that, then, motivated teachers who are into technology. Yesterday, I was talking to someone, and we were talking about all the stuff we carry around with us, right? It's like we're walking lopsided most of the time. And the person said, yeah, if I ever got mugged, I tell them, just take my wallet, but don't take my tech bag, whatever you do. Please don't take my tech bag. So it's really always fun to be in a room full of really motivated educators, and then educators with technology on their minds is really a joy. So hopefully we'll have some fun today. You have me today for about 7 hours, so you'll probably be throwing the Tootsie Rolls and the M&Ms and whatever else in those plates by the end of the day. But I really do want to make this your day as much as possible, and so that you walk out of here with whatever you need to take back to your schools to try to implement some of these technologies. Now, basically, I am about Web 2.0 technologies more than I am about multimedia and digital storytelling, although I think there's a lot of overlap. And so my kind of job today, or my kind of role today, is to give you some context as to how I think the web is really changing a lot about what we do in our classrooms, and show you some tools that you can use that maybe you can bring to your teachers or bring into your own professional practice that I think can really enhance what you do and also do some good things with technology as well. So this is going to be a little bit of a teaching day for me, because I want you to get some skills as you walk out of here with some technologies that you may not know much about. So just as a first question, how many of you are bloggers? Great, okay. And how many of you have used a wiki? How many of you collect RSS feeds as we speak? Maybe you are doing so right now. All right. How many of you do podcasts? All right. How many of you have done like video casts or screencast type of thing? And what I mean by that is created video or screen captures and then put them on the web for other people to look at and consume. All right, a couple of you. So some of you, this might be a little bit of like repeat stuff and maybe just review, but for others, hopefully there'll be some new stuff here and I'll be able to take you down some paths that maybe you haven't been down before. This is my blog, by the way, at weblogin.com. Anyone recognize that picture, by the way? This was at Newark Airport yesterday. Let me click on it. It'll take you to the Flickr site, so maybe you can guess to see who this is. See if any of you know. This is kind of a geeky celebrity, so I'm not sure that too many people. Although the first person who commented on my blog actually knew who it was, unfortunately. Well, more fortunately. Anyone guess who that is? Look familiar at all? Any of you at NEC in New Orleans? Keynote speaker?
Joyce Valenza?
No. Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote The Tipping Point and Blink. Do you know him? Kind of a geeky, that's why I said kind of a geeky celebrity. Maybe not too many of you know that, but actually the first person who commented that actually did know that. He happened to be in Newark Airport yesterday, and I actually called him by the wrong name. That's always wonderful to do when you meet somebody. Not a good start to that relationship with Malcolm. But great books, by the way, if you're interested in this. So my blog is here. My email's here if you want to email me at any point. I'm always interested in hearing about teacher experiences with these technologies, hearing what your successes and struggles are. And I also am going to be using this a lot today. This is a wiki that I have set up that has a lot of the links that we're going to talk about today. Certainly you're welcome to go to that. And I'll show it to you here in a sec. But you can actually add to that if you want. It's an interactive type of thing. So. The password to that is RWW, Read Write Web, and if you get a chance and you find things that you think would be good for the community of educators who are using these tools and you want to add it, you can do it there. And that is my book, picture of my book, and I have a couple copies, but it's called Blogs, Wikis, Podcasts, Other Powerful Web Tools for Classrooms. Basically written as an entry point for teachers who wanted to start understanding these technologies and start getting some context as to what's happening in broader terms with the web. So you might be interested in taking a look at that as well. And if you have any questions at any point through this, please just let me know. So we're going to talk about, obviously, very important things today. That's me, believe it or not. When I was, what was I, about seven? That was my mother's haircut that she gave me. Not real great. And does anyone know? Someone must know who the ball player is, right?
Ernie Banks.
That's right, Mr. Cub, huh?
That's play two.
That's right. Ernie Banks was my hero when I was growing up. Literally, I wanted to become Ernie Banks, and I used to listen to the Cubs games as much as I possibly could. I actually got the opportunity one time to go down on the field, and that's how I got that picture with Ernie Banks. But if you look up here, this is the program, and Leo DeRocher is on there, Ernie Banks, Billy Williams, Randy Hundley, Glenn Beckert, Ron Santo, a lot of the Hall of Famers. This was probably one of the most important days of my life as a kid. I mean, I was just like beaming about the opportunity to go down and meet these guys. And I just wanted to show you this one because I just wanted to show you that I knew how to dress for a baseball game. I don't know what he was thinking when he dressed up like that, but can you see it in my face? I mean, this was like, just a powerful moment for me. Now, the reason I show you that is because when I was a little kid growing up, obviously, the way that I found out about the Cubs was to listen to them on my transistor radio with the earphone running up my sleeve and into my ear during the middle of class sometime. And also reading the Sun-Times or the Tribune or whatever else. So I was able to consume information about the Cubs in pretty traditional ways. But today, we have blogs. We have the Sons of Hector Villanueva blog. Which, if you don't know who Hector Villanueva was, he was a really mediocre catcher for the Cubs for a while. And these guys, they basically will blog on a daily basis about what happens to the Cubs. We have all sorts of blogs about the Cubs, the Blue Army, look at all these, Cubby Corner, diehard Cubs fan, the Cubdom, Bleed Cubby Blue, Cub Reporter. Anybody, basically, who's a Cubs fan who wants to start writing about the Cubs can do so right now. Any Cubs fans in here, by the way? Ooh, wrong crowd to show the Cubs. White Sox fan?
Ask Cardinals.
Couple. Yeah, Cardinals fans? All right, there we go, sorry. Brewers fans? All right. But the point is that even though I live out in New Jersey now, I can still access all sorts of information about the Cubs whenever I want it. Although recently I haven't wanted any information about the Cubs because they've been playing so poorly, which I guess recently means about the last 87 years or something like that. And there's even a Cubs podcast that if I'm really diehard, I can listen to. I can download it to my iPod. I can listen to it in my car. These two guys sit in their basement and just basically cry a lot about what's happening. So, you know, this really is, I think, a changed world that we're kind of living in now, because there is so much more access to information and so much more, so many different ways now that we can collect information about the things that we're really passionate about, whether it's technology, whether it's the Cubs, whether it's whatever. I mean, we've never had so much access to information as we have right now. And what's interesting about it, to me at least, is that it's really not about the technology that much anymore, because the technologies are becoming easier and easier. I mean, you literally could be blogging in 5 minutes if you're not already a blogger. You could literally be doing a wiki in 5 minutes. You could, you know, access, and in fact, I took some pictures of the posters in the back. They're already up on Flickr. So the idea of creating content is just becoming so much easier that it's really not about technology anymore, but I really think it's about imagination. And I really think that as educators, we're in a very, very interesting time where really it's all about what you want to do. I was talking to Eric about this, you know, just before the meeting, and I love Eric's shirt, by the way. He's self-professed geek, you know. He's like, he's in touch with his inner geek. But it is about imagination. I mean, he was talking about all sorts of interesting things that he's doing in terms of making podcasts and sending them home as reviews and all sorts of things. This really is a time when if you're willing to put a little bit of time into it and if you're open to it, you can do all sorts of interesting things with the web and with communication. I want to give you a couple of examples of that. Have you heard of One Red Paperclip? How many of you have heard of One Red Paperclip? Good. Only two of you. So Kyle MacDonald is a guy up in Canada, I believe it was, and around Toronto, and he decided about a year ago now that he was going to take one red paperclip, start a blog, and decide to see if he could trade that one red paperclip up in succession until he got a house free and clear. This was his goal. Now, this is imagination, right? So he said, I started the blog and said, I have one red paperclip. Who's going to trade me? Someone said, well, all right, just for fun, I'll give you a fish pin for the one red paperclip. And he put that up on his blog, and he said, okay, what are you going to give me for the fish pin? Someone gave him a doorknob. Doorknob's kind of ugly, but someone really wanted it because they gave him a fairly old Coleman stove. So within four trades, he'd gone from one red paperclip to a Coleman stove that worked a little bit, and someone really wanted a Coleman stove because they gave him a generator, a Honda generator, for that. And he said, well, who's going to give me something for the generator? And he gets all sorts of offers for these things, by the way, and he gets to pick which one he wants. So for that one, he picked a party outfit with Budweiser IOU, a keg full of beer, very nice. Somebody really wanted that because they decided to trade him for a snowmobile.
Whoa.
Snowmobile. So, one red paperclip, snowmobile. Not bad, huh? Now, the snowmobile is obviously not new, needs some work. He put it up there, he said, who's going to give me something for the snowmobile? Someone said, well, I will give you a week in Yak, Canada, for your snowmobile. And everyone went, well, where's Yak? And it's actually a snowmobiling place, I guess, where a lot of people go up in northern Canada. And somebody really wanted to go there because they decided to give him a cube truck for a week in Yak. So now he started with a red paperclip. Now he's up to a cube truck. Now he could probably live in a cube truck if he wanted to. You know, this whole thing could be done, but he wanted to keep going. So for the cube truck, someone said, for some reason, they really wanted the cube truck. And by this time, it's not so much whether they even really want the stuff, but it's the publicity that they're going to get because they decide to make the trade. He gets a $12,000 professional recording contract at a studio in Toronto. Okay, so he puts that up on his blog, and he says, okay, what do you give me for that? Well, this woman in Phoenix really wanted a professional recording contract. She'd been dying to cut a record. So she gave him 1 year free rent at her really nice place in Phoenix, Arizona. 1 year, he could live there. All right, now, this is where he starts making some kind of sideways or interesting trades, because he went ahead and traded that for an afternoon with Alice Cooper, and I'm not sure why. Not sure why he did that, actually, but that's the direction he took. He then actually traded that for this kind of weird Kiss the band globe. Yeah. I don't know where he was going that, but actually someone traded him for that for a movie role in a movie with Corbin Barnes. Remember him from L.A. Law? I don't know, some of you probably remember L.A. Law. But so anyway, so that's where he's at right now. He's got a movie deal, but I actually should have checked it this morning, but he's got a movie deal up now so that someone can trade him for that. So, one red paperclip, making trades, and now he's got up there basically a movie role with in a major motion picture. Now that is imagination to me. And that's something that I don't think that we could have done even 2 or 3 years ago. Because of, number one, the ease with which we can do that, and number two, the reach that he has by being able to blog and by the networking and the power of the interconnectedness of the web these days. It's a really powerful and interesting thing. So I do think this is really about imagination. Now here I'm going to give you another example. Do you know what, you know what anime is? Anime, right? The kind of Eastern cartooning thing. There's a site on the internet called Anime Music Videos. I don't know if any of you have seen it. Okay, it's kind of interesting. Yeah, she's kind of rolling her eyes. It's kind of interesting. Because what they do is, they'll take anime clips from cartoons on TV or from movies, and then what they'll do is they'll mash up other songs or audio on top of them. So they'll take two very disparate things, slam them together, and they'll come up with some interesting effects for that, right? Now, so I want to show you one by a 19-year-old, and this gets a little bit weird at times, but I think hopefully you'll enjoy it.
And now, little lady, if you'll kindly step up to the parapet, I'll give you a lesson in marksmanship.
You could give me a lesson in long-distance spitting. Anything you can do, I can do better. I can do anything better than you.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can.
No, you
this
can.
Is where it gets weird.
No, you can't.
Yes, I can. Yes, I can.
Oh, that is.
I believe I can fly. I believe I can touch.
And Mac users ought to get a kick out of this one.
Paper on the PC. And it was like, beep, 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 beep. And then, like, half of my paper was gone. And I was like, it devoured my paper. It was really good paper. And then I had to write it again, and I had to do it fast, so it wasn't as good. It's kind of a bummer. I'm Ellen Feist, and I'm a student.
Anyone know what that's a takeoff on?
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
The Apple,
yeah, those old Apple Switch ads.
Yeah.
Remember those from about 5, 6 years ago where they had normal people? Actually, my niece was in one of those, Liza. She did one of those where she was talking about, you know, my dad got me a PC, and I'm trying to hook it up, and then I finally got a Mac. I was like, oh. Deliverance type of thing. But anyway, so, you know, it's not that hard to do that. I mean, the things that Hall was showing you yesterday, too. You know, it's just dropping one track in here, dropping another track in there, kind of making them sync up and doing some work with it. That's obviously a really good example of it. But the types of things that we can do now, I think, make this a very interesting and a very imaginative time. So, basically, it is about imagination, the ability to confront and deal with reality by using the creative power of the mind, resourcefulness, right? And I really think the reality that we're dealing with right now is the web. Without question. To me, and you know, obviously all of this is kind of a crapshoot because we don't know which way technology is going. Obviously it's moving very quickly. But to me the web is transformative right now. It is absolutely transformative. And it's transforming not only education, but it's transforming journalism, it's transforming business, politics, all parts of our lives in ways that I don't think people even considered just a few years ago. It's been real eye-opening for journalists. If you know any reporters out there, you know that the world is definitely a different place when any of us right now could be a reporter. Any of us, if there was an event that took place outside on the street right now, could run out with our cell phones, take a picture, have it up online, at a blog, and start pointing people to it within literally seconds. I mean, what happens to journalism when that happens, when we have that ability? So the web, I think, is really where things are changing. 1 billion people on the web, the 1 billionth person last year was supposedly a 24-year-old woman from Shanghai. And that's what the demographics say, but I always wonder if she turned on her computer and plugged it in and the computer had little balloons. And you're the 1 billionth person. 1 billion people, 2 billion people by 2015, by the way. 2 billion people by 2015 will be tapped into the web. 10 billion pages out there already. 1 trillion links, places where you can click on the internet, 1 trillion. And so the new reality, even with all that now, is not just the one-way web that we've been used to, but the rewrite web. The place where it's not just consuming information only, but creating information and sharing. And this is now what I think is really important for us as educators to consider, Web 2.0. Tim O'Reilly, who publishes computer books, and this may be a little bit of hyperbole, but in a commencement address just a few weeks ago, he said basically we're at a turning point, not just in technology, but maybe in the history of the world. And I am going to be interested, hopefully, we'll be able to look back 20 years from now and see what people are saying about this time, because
of the explosion in the way that we can start connecting and we can start sharing content. There are 40 million blogs. There are 70,000 new blogs every day. More than one per second, people are starting to write and create content. 1.2 million new posts of content every day created by people just like us. And 7 million new web pages every day. Now, it's overwhelming. It's absolutely overwhelming. And that certainly is one piece of what we have to consider about this web when we're teaching our kids. How do they deal with this? How do we deal with all this information, obviously, but how do they deal with it? What happens in a world where when everybody can read and write, you know, or can write stuff to the internet? What happens in the way that they have to be able to consume that information and look at it? 2.5 billion links, and Technorati, by the way, if you're interested in the blogosphere and what's happening with it, technorati.com is the place to kind of wrap your brain around it and really start to understand it. They have a great blog search tool, and also they do kind of a regular update on what's happening in the blogosphere. And, you know, so we're linking pages, which is what we always used to do on the web, but now, more than that, I think we're linking ideas. If someone in India or even Pakistan or anywhere where there's access, if someone has an interesting idea, we can find that person, we can link to that person, we can start to connect with that person and that idea in ways that we never were able to before. Conversation, certainly, the web is all about conversation now. There's a great book called the Clue Train Manifesto, which was written about 4 or 5 years ago, which basically was about business and the changes that are happening here. But basically the premise was, you know, markets are now conversations. What happens to businesses when their consumers can talk about the products in ways that they never could before? Certainly we as consumers know more about the products in many cases than even the manufacturers do. And we're connecting people in some very interesting ways. So a lot of people are starting to call this period, all sorts of names: society of authorship, age of participation, era of collaboration, age of engagement. This is a very active space. Thomas Friedman's book, The World is Flat, you may have heard of that. It's another one that you might want to read if you're interested in kind of what's happening because of these technologies. But he basically calls us all now uploaders, that we are a generation of people who can produce content and share it widely. And that is just a different kind of feeling or paradigm, if you'll excuse that expression, because I don't really like that word. But anyway, a shift in the way that we look at content and the things that we can do with it. Lawrence Lessig, another book, Free Culture, which talks a lot about copyright and a lot about the things that are happening, the stresses that are occurring on copyright law in Free Culture. Lawrence Lessig is a Stanford law professor. You know, the significance of this might be really, really important, probably will be really important, and something for us to see. And for educators, I think it's just extremely significant. This is something that we really have to understand. And that's why, even though today is a workshop day, I just think it's really important that you have context for the discussion that these tools revolve around, that you understand kind of the bigger picture of what's happening here, because we're all dealing with them in some way, whether it's a MySpace incident at our school, or whether it's, you know, the district looking at some of the sites that we're trying to pull in for our classes or whatever else. These changes are really important for us. There are almost 70,000 education blogs alone out there now. And Kristen was right. When I started blogging in 2001, which seems like an eternity ago in blog life, there were about 7 that I could find. I mean, there were literally handfuls of people who were kind of going, what's this kind of blog thing, and how can we use it in the classroom? And now it's like exploding around us. 12 million kids creating content online, and actually that has to be more, because we'll talk about MySpace a little bit, but MySpace now has 87 million people, and a third of those are kids. So, you know, we're looking at 25 million kids at least who are creating content online. They are doing this stuff on their own for the most part, and it's causing all sorts of disruptions, and it's causing all sorts of opportunities, bringing us all sorts of opportunities as well. So it is about imagination. They're creating all sorts of cool stuff. They're creating podcasts. This is Matthew Bischoff. And he was one of the early podcasters. And I just love this. I really want you to listen to his voice, okay, when I play this. And just listen to this kid and tell me what you hear.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Escape from the World with your host, Matthew Bischoff.
This is Escape from the World for Thursday, November 4th, 2004, and I am your host, Matthew Bischoff, from MatthewBischoff.com. For more information about podcasting or the iPodder client, just visit iPodder.org, and for more information about this show, just visit the homepage at MatthewBischoff.com. This is a podcast about technology, which features technology news, a site of the night, and other items of interest. My name is Matthew Bischoff, a 13-year-old from New Jersey, podcasting from my bedroom. And thanks for listening to this edition of Escape Radio.
I love that. I just love that. Podcasting from my bedroom. Now, what do you hear?
Excitement.
Excitement.
Yeah.
Energy. Passion. And, you know, the thing that always strikes me about this, and I've obviously listened to this hundreds of times, but I still hear it. I just love the sense of audience that this kid has. He understands that this is for people who he has no idea who they are, but they might listen to it. And what he really wants to do is to teach them. He wants to teach them what he knows. And, you know, again, I was saying to Eric before that podcasting has been the one technology out of all of these that I've had kind of the least kind of interest in, because it's not as social as some of the others. But I got to tell you, from that aspect of it, from kids being able to create content and publishing it to wide audiences where they can potentially teach other people, it reframes the whole concept of what we ask them to do. It just takes the whole idea of, here, give it to me and I'll grade it, to something much, much different. And you can hear it in his voice. And I think it's a really, really interesting shift and something that we have to really consider with this. This is my daughter, Tess. She just graduated to fourth grade. Is that me or is that somebody else? Okay, I just didn't want to make sure that wasn't me. Last year she had a weather project to do. So she said, well, I want to make a weather recipe book. And I was like, well, what do you mean? She goes, well, you know, if you want a tornado, what are the ingredients? You got to have cold air, you have a warm air, you have to turn it around, mix it up, and do all this stuff. So I said, okay, so that's pretty cool. I thought that was a pretty creative idea. So she went ahead and did this in paper form. And we scanned it in, and we actually put it on up on Flickr. Again, you know, Hall talked about it yesterday. If you haven't seen Flickr, it's a great site. We're going to talk about it more today. Tour. So you can see up here, here's her weather recipe book. There are all the pages. And Flickr's pretty cool because you can view it as a slideshow. You can do some interesting things here. And so it comes up. And this is really kind of nice for grandma and grandpa to see, you know, and for the relatives over in Sweden and everything else. And kind of self-running, and you can time it. And here's her little table of contents and a nice little self-portrait of her out in the snow. You know, she's so cute. So, now, the cool thing is, however, that Flickr will also register how many times a set has been read. And if you look down here, it's now been read 985 times. Now, at this point, I'll own maybe 100 of those, okay? But still, almost 900 times by people who I don't know who they are. That's impressive to Tess. She is really interested to see how many people are reading her book. And so now she's a blogger. She wants to blog. And the cool thing is that a number of my blogging buddies and I have kids about that same age, so we've set up these little blogging communities where they kind of read each other's blogs and comment back and forth. And it's really interesting. My six-year-old son, Tucker, he's a blogger too. My wife is a blogger. It's kind of the curse of living in my family. But the idea, again, that she can have an audience, even at 8 years old. Now this, by the way, blew her teacher away. When she went in and showed this to her teacher, she was just like, well, what do you mean people are reading your book? Really didn't understand what was happening. But as soon as she saw it, she was like, wow, that's really cool. And Tess was really excited about it. So the idea, again, that we can publish easily, that we can share the things that our kids do on a wide basis with large audiences, I think is really important. And I just want to show you one more. This is Sandeck Primary School in Scotland, where the kids keep a blog. This is their website. This is it. And the kids keep it. The kids do it. It's all a blog about the things that are happening. They take the pictures. They upload them, pretty much. They put movies up there. Natasha's doing reviews, and they have books and all sorts of stuff. The kids are in charge of this. The kids are the ones who are creating all of this and putting it up there for the people in that community to share.
So there's no reason why we have to do this anymore. We can turn it over to our kids because they can do blogs and videos, spoken word, they can do digital storytelling, music and games. But the important piece of it is, I think, is that they don't just do it in the enclosed four walls of our classroom anymore, right? They can really do it now, go beyond, far beyond what they've been able to do just for us. And it just changes things in such an important way that I think it's just a powerful shift. So they really are teaching. They really can teach every assignment, everything that we give them to do. We can repurpose it and say, do this in order to instruct other people about what you know. Because you're going to be sharing it to a larger audience. It's going to go beyond this classroom, beyond your friends, beyond me. And really, think about it in that way. There's a great site, too, called Fanfiction. Fanfiction is just amazing what kids are doing. You know, mostly kids. I'm sure there's lots of adults there, too. But Fanfiction is a place where you can go in and you can basically add chapters or kind of do additional stories to books that are out there. Harry Potter has something like, I think, I don't know where it is now, 18,000 pieces of writing that people have done to kind of extend the stories and to move, you know, to just be creative about the types of things that could be going on in that book. And Al November tells a story where he was talking to a girl about why she put her stuff up on Fanfiction and did it anonymously. And she said, because I don't want people to know who I am. I just want them to let me know what they think about my writing, what they think about my work type of thing. And I think that's interesting. You know, it is. It's something that, again, we can get larger audiences for kids, and that can be really helpful to them. This is another blog. This is Darren Kirpatwa, who has just been doing amazing things. He's in Canada, and he's a calculus teacher. And he uses blogs to do a whole bunch of things with his class, but one of them that I think is really interesting is that he has his kids do these scribe posts. And what it is basically, at the end of the day, he has one student designated to summarize everything that happened in class and also to add to it. So go beyond what we did in class, give more examples, instruct your classmates to make sure that they understand the concepts that we've been talking about. And this is just a really pretty amazing thing, if this will work from over here, I think it will. Basically, if you just look at this, it just goes on and on and on. This is one post that this student put in about that particular class, and on and on. Now, the interesting thing is that, that's the end of it, and I love that, it's not fair. The interesting thing of it now is that he's got a Scribe Post Hall of Fame. The kids have made this a competition. And they've been trying to do the absolute best posts of anyone in the class. And Darren talks about how it's just really motivated them to just go far beyond the thinking that they were doing just, you know, by sitting in class and kind of telling back what they learned. So they are learning. This is another site from Flickr, which I think is really interesting. I don't know if you knew you could do this, but on Flickr you can put pictures up and you can put drawing little boxes of annotation that you can then add some information to. So if you come and you just kind of put your mouse on one of these, it's a piece of annotation that you can go in. Look at this fire screen. Now, the really cool thing I think about this, though, is that what happens on Flickr, too, is then you get a conversation going about that particular piece of learning. And so you have all these people in the class, and this is one particular class that people are deconstructing the image right there, and they're having an asynchronous conversation about what's going on with that. So, again, the idea that we can start doing these things and start doing them in ways that really kids are learning and teaching, and they're building networks. Now, I really think this is the big deal, because when you have a world where you have access to a billion people, while some people might look at that as a billion predators, perhaps, I look at it as a billion teachers and a billion people who can inform their learning potentially. Now, we have to teach our kids how to do this well, obviously. We can't just like throw them online and say, okay, figure it out. Go find your own networks type of thing. But I have to tell you, I have learned more from being a blogger than any other education experience in my life. There's no question. And I went, you know, I have a master's degree. I have thousands of credits past my master's almost, it feels like. But nothing has taught me more than being a blogger, without question. And it's because of the network that I have of really motivated, highly just highly motivated people who want to learn with me. And I'll show you my network in a little bit, but this is where I learn every day. This morning, when I woke up, I just took a little bit of time and I looked through the things that the people in my network were writing about, and there were some really cool things that I tried out, and I was like, wow, that is really interesting. So it's not necessarily about just being in the classroom, it's about building these networks. Now, they're doing the network building already at MySpace and all those other places, right? But there are really positive ways that we need to teach our kids to build networks, because they can. They have access to all these people, and we can go way beyond what we do in our classroom. So I really think it is different now, and the kids know it. Clarence Fisher, who's a blogger teacher in Canada, gave a final exam on blogs and podcasts because he uses them so much, and this was one of the responses from his kids, and I love this. Now that we have podcasting and blogging, anyone can do it. You don't need to be some rich person in New York. You can produce from your own home. And it also changed the way we learn in today's society. But I love that. You don't need to be some rich person in New York. Think of that kid's mindset, right? This used to be beyond my reach, right? It was only those big media moguls who smoke cigars who were able to... Not anymore. Not anymore. I can do this too. Whether I'm 6, whether I'm 60, doesn't matter what age I am. I can start to contribute and I can start to be a part of this whole conversation of these networks. So harnessing this potential is really not about the technology, it's about imagination. I really believe that. And I think that you guys seem to be at least a very imaginative group, that hopefully today as we go through this, you'll think out of the box about ways that you can start maybe taking these tools back to your schools and your teachers and looking at how they might be used. Because the traditional classroom walls really are kind of coming down. So computers haven't really changed the world, but I think this might. I really think this might. When you look at blogs coming out of Iraq, Afghanistan, when you look at the world in terms of how it's being connected, in terms, again, of the way that we can access information, something's changing here, I think. Something's transforming. There's something transformative about the web. So the question is, to what extent do these changes that are happening out there make us rethink our curriculum? Make us think about what we do in the classroom? I think that's kind of the major overlying question here. So there's some big changes coming down the road, and I just want to talk about 6 of them fairly briefly. All right. First of all, we're moving from a world that is a very closed world in our classrooms, where we basically are still kind of dependent on textbooks, and where basically the things that we give our kids are proprietary types of content. And so we're going from classrooms that look like this, still. I had a conversation once with someone who said, you know, since all the glaciers are melting now, unfortunately, what if there was, you know, there happened to be a teacher from 80 years ago who had gotten frozen in the glacier and now got unfrozen and stepped out and walked back to her classroom and stepped back in. She'd probably, without too much trouble, be able to start teaching fairly quickly. Right? The desks are still pretty much in rows. There's still something at the front of the room to draw on. There's still all the little things hung up around. The four walls are still, right? It's not really that much different. Well, some places are different, I'm sure. But, you know, so we're going from something like that to something like this. Have you seen MIT OpenCourseWare? This is amazing. MIT has decided to put over 500 of its courses online for free. Totally online for free. And when you look at some of the courses that they have, it's just amazing. So, if you come down here, you can see basically the whole list on the left-hand side over there. It's a little hard to do with this, but you can see biology, brain, and cognitive sciences, chemical engineering, chemistry, economics. And then if you go into the individual courses, you can see the listings of courses that they have. So they have some brand new ones. They have 2005. In fact, I think there's probably some from 2006. So that's pretty cool. But if you look at individual courses then, look what you get. You get the syllabus, the calendar, the readings, the recitations, the assignments, the exams with the answers, by the way. Not just the questions, but the answers as well. You get the study materials, discussion group, and best of all, with this one, you get every video lecture that that professor gave for that particular class. Now, not all of them are like this, but again, the concept that we're just giving it away. We're saying, here, have an MIT education, almost, obviously. And some people would look at that and weigh the cost of an MIT education against maybe, you know, putting together a study group and doing this and saying, oh, I'll take that, you know. And think of all the kids in the world who would never have access to an MIT education as well. So the idea that we are basically opening up this content and saying it's not proprietary anymore, it's not something that's neatly packaged in a textbook, it really changes a lot about what we can do with the things in the classroom. And so we get texts also that used to look like this, and now we're moving to digital format, number one, but digital texts like this are still they're still texts. What I'm talking about is something like this, which is the entire South African high school curriculum on a wiki, where anybody can come in and edit it and add to it and amend it at any time. Now, that can be good or bad, and you know, this could be presentation hell because I didn't check it this morning. But you can come in here, if you're a physics teacher especially, you can look down on this side, and you can look at, this is the whole free high school science physics text. And if you come in here to, let's say, the waves section, you can take a look at the different things that that they have here. Okay? Now, the cool thing is about this, like I said, however, is that it's open. If I know something about waves, I can just click edit this page and add it. So that the next person that comes in gets the benefit of my knowledge. Now, this could be a good thing or a bad thing, I understand that. But the concept is that we can create our own texts if we want to. We're not subject to the textbooks that we're kind of used to. We can use weblogs, we can use wikis, websites, news, books, forums, PvP, podcasts, screencasts. Basically, we can become, well, it's a rip, mix, and learn society, which, you know, Apple, I think, was rip, mix, and burn, something like that. But rip, mix, and learn, which I think is interesting. And we can literally be DJs. I love this metaphor. Someone was writing about this on his blog. You know, what about a teacher as a DJ? Because, again, the curriculum doesn't have to be linear step to step. We can do this. We can go to H2O Playlist, which is a site that's listed by Harvard, and we can just collect all sorts of cool resources about whatever topic we want. So, and you don't have to do it here. You can do this on a wiki. You can do this anywhere else. But I just put together a set of resources for Martin Luther King. So we have basically the idea that you can start a blog about it. We have his own words, the letter from Birmingham Jail. We have his speech. We have an NBC News video. I'm sure there's stuff from United Streaming that we could pull in, you know, and all that type of stuff from Discovery. But I can then, as I'm teaching this lesson, just click on any of these resources and bring them up. It's like the DJ on the dance floor, right? Depending on the mood of the crowd, right? The mood of your students. What do they need? Maybe what they need isn't in that pretty closed kind of text that we've had in the past, and we can do something like this instead. So that's pretty cool. And the other thing is it's open source. The web is becoming an application, right? And again, Hall talked a lot about this last night too. But probably within 5 to 10 years, we're not going to be loading a lot of software on our computers, whatever it is. We're going to be running software through the web, right? We're going to have all these applications that are going to be web-based that we can just get into and we can run. And a good example of that is we're moving now from Office, Microsoft Office, to thinkfree.com, which is basically 1 gig of space for free for Word, PowerPoint, and Excel. You don't need Office anymore. Each of your kids, if you have access, can go online. They can start an account here, get 1 gig of online file storage for free. They can start creating Word documents, PowerPoint presentations, Excel documents, spreadsheets, all those types of things. Google just released the Google spreadsheet type of thing. You probably heard about that. So this whole idea is that we're moving to a much more kind of open content and open source type of environment where a lot of the things that we're very used to. And a lot of schools get very nervous about this because we like it neatly packaged. We like knowing exactly what we have. But that's not the reality of the world anymore. The reality of the world is that there's a lot more stuff out there for us to use. And there are other examples of this, too. I mean, ThinkFree is not the only one. Okay, so secondly, we're also moving now from individual learning spaces to collaborative learning networks. And I think this is one of the biggest shifts and most important ones to really think about. Because, as I said, you know, I said it a few times already, the whole concept of classroom has got to start changing. Because the four walls of what we're doing in there is fairly limiting when you have access to the sum of human knowledge. You know, it's dependent on how you bring it in. So we can go to 43 things. Any of you know 43 things? All right, this is an example of it. You know, basically you go to 43 things and you say, okay, these are the 43 things I want to learn. I want to learn how to play the trumpet. I want to learn how to, cook a certain meal. I want to learn how to speak Italian, whatever. As soon as you put those things in, you're automatically connected to everyone else in that whole community who wants to learn those same things. And we're given a blog, we're given a space to interact, and so we can start a community of learners around that particular topic for free. Now, some of it works, some of it doesn't, but the concept, again, is that, you know, we can do this. Do you know what the number one thing people want to learn on 43 things is? Kind of ironic. No? How to stop procrastinating. I love that. So this is my network. Basically, I'm there in the middle somewhere. There I am, Weblog Ed. That's my blog. And this is George Siemens from Canada. And this is Ann Davis from Georgia. And this is Bud the Teacher, Bud Hunt in Colorado. And this is Jay Cross and all these other, Alan Levine in Phoenix. These are the people who I have kind of built my network around. I don't need a classroom anymore. I just need connection. I need to be in contact with these people in order to learn. Now, I'm not saying that this is good for, you know, all of our students. Obviously, I'm an adult learner. You know, I'm motivated in certain ways. We have to teach our kids how to do this, however. We have to teach our kids how to create their own networks, I think, because that's going to be an important skill for them to have in the future as they go into business and they go and hopefully, look, and the goal is we want them to be continual learners, right? And, that's the other thing, too. I think they really can be now. We all can be now. I was saying this to someone last night at dinner who was talking about how, you know, teachers are scared and of technology at times. And I said, yeah, I don't know if it's fear so much or if they just kind of stop learning. You know? If they just kind of said, you know, I'm kind of done. I don't want to keep doing this. Well, you can. Why wouldn't you? Right? That's the kind of thing we need to tell our kids. We need to show them. They can be lifelong learners now because they have access to the information that they need in order to learn. So this is BlogLines, and this is, I'm going to show you this today. We're going to set up a BlogLines account, but this is basically my network of learners. These are my RSS feeds that I collect, and actually there's going to show a lot more unread messages here than that are really the case because I'm using kind of another aggregator too. But if you just look at this list, Aaron and Alan and Ann and Barbara, Bud, Charlie, Dave, Ian, Dave Warlick, Jenny Levine, all these people are bloggers who are writing about their practice, writing about their experiences, writing about their ideas. And the great thing is that I can go to their blogs and I can comment back to them and I can start to have conversations with them. They can come to my blog. I can Skype them. Last night I did a Skype call at like 11 o'clock last night with Chris Lehman, who's going to be the new principal at Science Leadership Academy in Philadelphia, who's a great blogger. And had just a really interesting conversation with him about, you know, he's interested in doing one-to-one laptops at his school. But I can contact these people. I don't need, you know, the same to be in the same room with them any longer. And all I need to be able to do, however, is to make sure that I can set up my network.
Could you, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
If you lost me, where is this located, this list, on what?
Well, we're going to start our own lists and our own sites today, but it's bloglines.com. That's where I go. But that happens to be mine.
Yeah.
But I'm going to show you how to start setting your own up, too.
I just had a question. I know she said you could comment on other people's.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have to necessarily be registered?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's nice.
No, you can come to my blog and just leave a comment. Mm-hmm. And you can be anonymous if you want.
You know what I'm saying? You don't have to register to whatever.
No.
You've already been online.
So, you know, Dewey said education is a social process, and now it really can be, and it really is becoming a social process. This is the Wikipedia entry of social networks that are out there right now. And social networks are sites where people can join up and kind of get connected to one another. Many of them are based on your professional interests or your personal interests. A lot of them are around music and other things, but some of them are just social. Some of them are just places where, you know, where you get together with people. So 250,000 people there, 18 million people on blackplanet.com, 40 million people on Classmates, 7 million people on Facebook and growing like mad, right? I don't know, any of you have Facebook accounts?
Teenagers do.
You teenagers have them, okay. Facebook is the new MySpace, but it's for kind of like for older kids, but or adults too.
You know, and look at this list. I mean, look at all these people who are joining these social networks. And of course, there is the big one. We're up to 88,193,000 people right now on MySpace. And that number, you know, they're adding 250,000 people a day right now. 250,000 people a day. And they are now expanding to other languages, other countries, and trying to replicate that model for other people. So this idea that we can connect with people is something that, whether we think it's a good thing or not, it's happening, right? Our kids are definitely doing this. And again, we'll talk a little bit more about MySpace in a minute, but it's interesting as to why they're doing this as well, and it's something that we need to understand, I think, and we really need to kind of tap into. And social bookmarks, this is Delicious. I'm going to show you this a little bit later too, but Delicious is a place where when I save an online bookmark, like this one I did this morning, Things to Do with Rightly, which is another kind of word alternative, I can find out other people who are saving that. So using Wikis in Education, 28 other people have saved that particular site in their own bookmarks, and so I can go and learn from them too. So even knowledge acquisition, knowledge archiving, becomes social in the way that we do it. We can work together. And I'll show you some neat things that you can do with Delicious later on today to start building that kind of idea. And we can do social photos, obviously, right? Here's Flickr. And let's see if the ones that I took this morning are up there already. Yep, there they are. They're already up there. I sent them up there with my trio. So, you know, I just go back there, take a picture, send email, and then put the camera in my pocket. And I'm done. And it shows up up here. So now I can link to it. I can annotate this. I can do whatever I want with it. Imagine the power of a cell phone like that in a kid's hands. And I think Hall mentioned this again yesterday, too. You know, why are we taking their cell phones away? I mean, they are absolutely, potentially very powerful tools that they can use. So social is the name of the game right now. It's all about social. And on Flickr, I love it. You know, Flickr has groups where people get together around content about their interests. You know, so there's like a soccer group. And there's also now called a Vegafidi group. Anyone want to guess what Vegafidi is? Something about vegetables. Well, not just vegetables, but... No, Vegafidi. Well, what's the last part? Feedy. Graffiti. All right, graffiti on vegetation. Yeah, vegetation. So it's pictures of people who have carved hearts and things into trees. There's a couple up there with cacti, you know, the people who have carved into. So there's a group of people who are really just into Vegafidi, and they found each other on Flickr. Isn't that a wonderful thing? How would that ever have happened before? Never would have happened except for Flickr, right? It's a beautiful moment. You know, whatever. Okay, we're moving from an environment that is just-in-case learning, right? Why do we teach most of our kids the stuff we teach them? Just in case you need to know this, right? I think that, and I will tell you, I'm not happy with the public school education that my kids are getting. I'm sorry, I'm not. Because my kids are like studying the state capitals, memorizing the state capitals. I'm going, why? Why are you memorizing the state capitals? Why do you need that? And I'm sure that the answer is, well, just in case you need it. And I'm sure there's a memorization aspect of it as well. But there's a lot of stuff that we teach our kids just in case they're ever going to need it. But what we should be thinking is, well, learn how to find it if you need it. Right? Instead of just in case, just in time. I need to know this particular formula. I didn't memorize it. I don't need to memorize it anymore. I can go online and find it really fast. But I need to know how to do that. I need that skill, that retrieval skill, that information literacy skill, on how to bring that information to me when I need it. So there's a lot of stuff that we, and you know this, you know this. How much of the stuff that you learned in school don't you remember anymore? How much of it did you never use? Okay. So it's pull versus push. I want to pull the information in that I need when I need it. I don't want to have it pushed into my brain anymore. And again, it's because I can pull it now. I can access it. I can bring it in if I have the skills and the tools and the knowledge to do that. That's not the case a few years ago. It's not as easy as it wasn't as easy even just a few years ago. But it is now. And so again, it's these tools that we have to give our kids. I can learn anything, anywhere, anytime. Anything. If I need it, if I want. You know, this is the future, right? Phones. This is the origami device that Microsoft has been talking about. I don't know if you've heard of it, but basically it's the one that basically fits in your pocket. It's a tablet tablet PC type of application. It's has a wireless card. So basically it's a game console that I can do just about anything with online, whatever. It's my computer. And Philadelphia, a lot of other cities now are trying to build a wireless cloud over the entire city. And that's kind of the way of the future. So basically we are going to be ubiquitously connected and pervasively proximate. Remember that. And what that means is, at some point down the road, odds are pretty good, we're going to have nonstop internet connection. And if we have a device that we know how to manipulate with that nonstop internet connection, we will always be proximate or close to the information I need. It'll only be a few clicks away if we know how to get there. Right? In Japan, you go on a train from the northernmost part of Japan to the southernmost part of Japan, you never lose your internet connection. Never lose it. And so that's where we're going. So we need to be able to find the information when we need it, because we're going to be able to find the information when we need it. Not memorize it all, not store it up here just in case we need it at some point. The learner decides. The learner can decide when, where, and how she learns. And I don't want you to think that, you know, we're going to have a whole bunch of, like, independent third graders running around going, I don't want to learn about this, I don't want to learn about that. That's not what I'm talking about. But I am talking about giving them the skills to be able to do that, right? To be able to go out and find the information that they need when they want it and when they need it. You know, I keep thinking, my son is kind of the horrible family secret, but he loves Power Rangers, I can't say that. But he loves Power Rangers. You know, we tried everything. And they don't watch too much TV, but the only TV he watches is Power Rangers. But, you know, I'm like, well, why not teach Tucker how to read in the context of Power Rangers? Why not teach him science in the context of Power Rangers? There's a lot of stuff you could teach in the context of Power Rangers, you know, and that type of thing. So the learner has to be more independent. And I kind of like this phrase, and this is how I feel I am. I am a nomadic learner. I graze. I do. I graze when I learn. I don't pick up a book and start turning pages. Or, you know what I'm saying? I kind of move where I need to go. If there's something I need to learn, I find it, I follow it until I learn it. I keep looking for it until I find it. And so I may be here one day, here the next, but I'm almost never in the same place doing the exact same thing over and over and over again every day. Okay, we're going from text to multimedia, no doubt. You saw it yesterday. Text. You know, I know Kristen said, you know, kind of low-tech paper here, and I was kind of thinking, well, we could have done this on a wiki. We could have all gotten it together on a wiki, but that's okay. Multimedia is definitely moving. iTunes is I don't know if I can bring this up, but have you looked at the podcast list for K-12 in iTunes lately? It's huge. It's amazing. There must be over 1,000, at least 1,500. Just a huge number of things that kids are doing in multimedia. And I don't know where we're going here. Oh, yeah, the Bering Strait School District, Student Broadcasting Team. This is one. I'm not going to show you this one, but these guys are actually doing a regular video now, a video podcast. They're doing a newscast, like, every week out in Alaska, right? And they are sharing it with the world. They are putting it up there so that you can bring it down and you can look at it. And I'm sure there's probably a lot of people from Bering who are interested in that. But even I'm interested in something. You know, the way the kids are taught. They were talking to a guy who worked on a king crab boat, right? And you should hear his life. I mean, God, how much money do you have to get paid in order to work on one of those boats? It is scary. I mean, it is scary what they go through every day. They put their lives on the line, basically, to pull up these big cages of crabs. I mean, it's unbelievable. But anyway, it was an interesting story, and the kids were the reporters, and they did the whole newscast that way. Okay, I'm going to show you this one. Anyone know World of Warcraft? Okay, so this is Othello via World of Warcraft. This is similar to what Hall showed you yesterday. This is on Bud the Teacher's blog, and we'll play a little bit of this. It's kind of hopefully it'll come in. It's a little bit... It's kind of interesting. He had his parents apparently do some of the vocals for this. So we'll see how this comes in. But here's Othello.
Money! money. Money, money, money. Bunny, 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 bunny!
All right, now, you know, the subtext here is, too, look how easy it was for Bud to include this in his blog. You know, look how easy it was for him to take this and just publish it up there for people to see. So there's absolutely no doubt that multimedia is the way things are going. And multimedia has all sorts of forms now in terms of weblogs and wikis, audio, cast, photos, videos, digital stories, bookmarks, screencast feeds, all sorts of different things that we can do with that. It is a digital portfolio loosely joined, which is, I think, another neat metaphor for this. Small Pieces Loosely Joined is the book by David Weinberger. It's another one that you should read. In fact, if of all of them, Small Pieces Loosely Joined might be the best one to read in terms of just getting a sense of how these things are changing things in the real world out there. So multimedia is definitely important. Another shift is, you know, we've always told kids work alone. And the premise has always been, yeah, you can show other kids, but basically I'm the one that's going to grade this. So who are you working for? Who's the boss? Who's the man? I am. You know, I mean, that's just the way it's kind of set up. I hated it. As a writing teacher, I especially hated the idea that I had to assess kids' writing. I thought that was just the worst thing. I mean, you know how kids come in with different experiences. Some kids love writing. Some kids had great writing teachers. Others didn't. You know, I mean, how can you put them on the same level and grade their output like that? It's very difficult. But the shift is now to working together with an audience of many. And Wikipedia is like the poster child for this, right? Now, Wikipedia, a lot of people have trouble with Wikipedia. A lot of people kind of go, ooh, let's not go there. But we have to go here. We have to go here and understand this. Because basically, this is a place now with 1.2 million articles in English. And with, I think they're up to something like 44 other languages now, where these encyclopedias are being created by people just like you and I, people just like you and me, there's the English teacher, who are contributing information because we know it or because we find it or whatever else. And yeah, some of it is not great information, obviously, because anyone can come in there and do anything at any time. But you may have heard about the Nature magazine study that compared Wikipedia to Britannica, and found that Wikipedia was only slightly more inaccurate than Britannica, and that the biggest attribute for Wikipedia was it was so current. Wikipedia was like, you know, at least, I'm sorry, Britannica is like 3, 4, 5, maybe 10 years old, depending on how long it's been since, you know, you've been able to purchase it. But Wikipedia has very current information. So we can't just say, well, you can't use Wikipedia. Because kids are using Wikipedia. My favorite story is the kid who had a report to do, didn't really want to do it, so he did a pretty crummy job of it, put it up on Wikipedia, sat back, watched as everyone else came in, edited it, made it better, right? It revised it, made it really good, took it down, handed it in to his teacher. Now, his teacher caught him because she knew that he couldn't have written what he ended up handing in. But the concept, kids get this. You know, and I was reading, actually on the plane, I was reading the New Yorker magazine this week, and there was, I probably shouldn't do this without actually quoting it, but there is a huge, huge ethical push that's coming with all of this, too, you know? I mean, how do we control the ethics of all of this? How do we deal with this from an ethical standpoint? I mean, there's so many ways that we can abuse this, and kids are doing it, we're doing it. You know, that's another discussion that we have to have. But Wikipedia is just crucial for us to kind of accept and to understand because, again, whether we like it or not, here's the charts on Wikipedia. The blue is Wikipedia. The red is New York Times. So whether we like it or not, we have to understand this. We have to teach our kids about this. We have to teach them how to use it well. I would say teach them how to contribute to it, how to be a part of it as well. I love this. You know, we always tell our kids, hand it in. What if we told them, publish your work tonight? Don't forget to publish your homework tonight. It's a little bit of a shift, and I'm not saying they publish everything. Please, don't publish everything. But your good stuff, publish it, right? Put it out there. I'll collaborate with peers from around the world. You'll collaborate with your peers from the classroom. Yeah, I think I'd take A rather than B. And students can teach, like we talked about. Okay, and last, writing and reading literacy. and information and network literacy. We still need to know how to read and write, but we have to know how to read and write very differently these days in hypertext environments, by the way. The more that we're doing on the web, the less linear it's getting. And we're teaching kids how to read in a linear way and to write in a linear way. But that's not the way the world is going. We're going into a world where we click on a lot of links and reading doesn't become linear anymore. Reading becomes very distributed all over the place. And David Weinberger uses this great metaphor. You know, we used to judge paper and written texts on the value of what they contained, right? And that's still pretty much what we do. But what we have to do is we have to start thinking about the value of where they point us to, where they lead us to. How much value is there in a text that doesn't take us anywhere else these days? And that's why paper is getting more and more kind of limited and restrictive. There's a great, great article, you have to read it if you didn't, New York Times Magazine about 6 weeks ago, The Future of the Book. If you didn't read it, you have to go find it. And actually, I think I have a link on the wiki to it. But it talks about, you know, Google is scanning 5 million books from the biggest research libraries in the world. Amazon is scanning. Everybody's scanning. They're sending crate loads of books from libraries over to China to be scanned. Read this article. It's just amazing what they're doing. And the future is that you'll read a book and be able to click on links within that book. It'll be hypertext, and it'll take you to the source of that particular information. And then that'll take you to the source of that information. Now, I know you're going, how do we do that? Well, we have to figure it out. And we have to get our kids to figure it. We have to help our kids figure that out. Because they're doing it right now. They're like click happy. Right? Not to make a joke about ADD, but you know, I mean, there is a lot of that behavior happening online. I have a lot of it myself. It's very difficult for me sometimes to sit down with a book anymore and turn pages. Because I want to go, whoa, let me click on that. And it doesn't take me anywhere. Yeah.
Well, the Da Vinci Code has the illustrated Da Vinci Code now.
Really?
And that's kind of like that, where when they come to something that they don't know about that section in that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's on hard copy.
Right. But I mean, this is the world that our kids are going to grow up into, without question. I mean, they're going to be creating documents with all sorts of hypertext in it, and they're going to be reading documents that have all sorts of hypertext in it. So, information and network literacy are really important. Now, readers to editors is the most important thing, I think, of all of this. In a world where everyone can create information and put it up online without having anyone edit it, we all have to become the editors. We all have to be the ones to edit the information. And I know many of you have probably seen this, martinlutherking.org. If you haven't seen it, this is kind of like the poster child for information literacy. But this is a site, basically, that martinlutherking.org, if you search for Martin Luther King, I think it comes up second. Kidsthink.org, ooh, good thing, right? Good site, must be good. It says up here, attention students, try our MLK pop quiz, download flyers to pass out at your school. They're marketing this site to kids, basically. And it looks pretty reputable, somewhat reputable, until you go over here and you read, the FBI bugs reported picked up 14 hours of party chatter, the clinking of glasses, the sounds of illicit sex, including King's cries, I'm effing for God and I'm not a Negro tonight. Number 3 or 2 on Google, this comes up. And you know kids, right? If it's number 5, they're not going to get to it. Now, if kids don't know how to get behind this and figure out who owns this site, they're basically illiterate at this point. If we don't know, we're basically illiterate. Who owns this site? I'm not going to ask you if you do, but it's imperative that we all become editors about the information that we see. We have to do the job that people who were paid to review books used to do, because they're not doing it anymore. We are. This is owned by Stormfront, the White Aryan Nation. It is a racist group that is basically trying to inculcate our children with false ideas about Martin Luther King. And if you wanted to know how to find that out, if you wanted to find out any website address, who owns it, you would go to a place called Easy Who Is, easywhois.com, and just put in the web address. Okay, I'll just show it to you real fast, because it is a crucial, just very easy skill. Whoop. Easy Who Is, come down here, you just enter the domain, in this case, Martin Luther King,
www.iPodderclient.org. And all the information about that particular site comes up here. Now, I always think this is really ironic, but the site is owned by Stormfront by a guy named Don Black, ironically. But if you want to contact Mr. Black about this, you have his phone number, you have his fax number, you have all the information, mailing address, etc., about him. And this is true of any domain on the internet. So this is like stop number one. And then there are other things that we have to teach our kids to be able to do with that information, because even this, you know, is a little bit difficult to figure out. But we have to cue them in. Yeah. No, because they're not top-level domains usually. They're at like Blogspot or they're at, you know, some other place. Like mine would, because I have purchased weblogged.com. I have registered that domain so that no one else can use it. But with, like MySpace, no. No, wouldn't that be nice? Right? Just click on who put it in who is and figure out who the kid is. No, that's not the way that works. You can find out who owns MySpace, MySpace.com, but not those subdomains.
So we need to make sure that they're editors. We need to make sure that we are editors and that our teachers are editors, that we all have the skills to navigate this stuff. Dan Rather, right, the papers that said that George Bush had not done his National Guard service, remember that? Mm-hmm. Sure you do. And basically within a couple hours, people were printing them out on their own HP laser jets and saying, well, how can you use those as fact? He still believes to this day that those documents that he had were accurate. Now, you know, whether or not the president actually did his service, but those particular documents. And so the blogosphere said, no way, come on, you know, what are you talking about? They edited him, basically, better than his own editors did. Trent Lott, I love that picture, who at Strom Thurmond's 100th birthday party, let's think about that for a second, said, you know, if we listened to Strom Thurmond back in the day, we wouldn't have all the problems we have right now. Now, if you know a little bit about Strom Thurmond, you know that he was a Dixiecrat, basically a racist, basically, I think Dixiecrat is correct, is that not right?
Sorry.
Yeah, okay. That, you know, he was a racist. In fact, the other day I saw the ballot that had Strom Thurmond on it when he first ran for governor, and basically it said, you know, if you want to save the white race, vote this way, type of thing. So Trent Lott says this, and everybody in the room is like, oh, that's nice, you know, took another drink and whatever else, but there's a blogger in the back of the room who just kind of went, what did he just say? Excuse me? And blogged about it. And a week later, other people started blogging about it. 2 weeks later, he was on Black Entertainment Television saying, I didn't really mean what I said. But the next week, he resigned the Senate Majority Leader because he got edited. Because someone was listening. Someone was looking at it. All right? And that's the type of thing that we have to get into. From writers to designers. There's another book. Here's another one. I'm gonna just summer reading, right? It's the beginning of summer. You have lots of time to read. A Whole New Mind by Daniel Pink. Great book. Talks about how right-brainers are going to take over the world, basically, finally. And he basically says that, again, imagination and creativity are what we really need entering a world that's beginning to look like the way it is. So we need designers. We need design, story, sympathy, empathy, play, and meaning. And again, those are the types of literacies, almost, that we have to be able to give our kids. We have to make them take this information, take this content, and be creative with it. Be imaginative with it. Not just spit it back. Right? We've got to get rid of standardized tests. Ugh. We have to do it. Somehow. This is what we need. We need creative thinkers, not regurgitators. Network literacy, working in distributed collaborative environments, is one of the most difficult things, and I find this too, and if you're a blogger and you read a lot of blogs, you probably find this too. The most difficult thing for me about the blogosphere is how all over the place it is. I may start a conversation here, someone over there may comment on it and link back to me, and they may have comments in their list that then go to another blog that talks about that same idea, but it's like three steps away now, and it's like all over the place, and there's ways to kind of bring that stuff together, but it's difficult. It's difficult to keep on that conversation and to keep going with that conversation the way it is. So, you know, how does reading change in hypertext environments? And how does writing change? I mean, all those types of things. So, more content, more information, more knowledge, faster than ever before, more transparent, more collaborative. Things are changing. The questions are, what needs to change when our students can publish to audiences far beyond us? What do we need to do about our curriculum when that's the case? If anything, but it's just a question. How does a teacher's role change When I'm not the sole arbiter of knowledge in my classroom anymore, how does my role have to change? I mean, the way I tried to change when I was in the classroom was I tried to become more of a connector, right? My kids read Secret Life of Bees. This is, you know, the first blogging thing that I did that was, it was really pretty successful because we had the author, Sue Monk Kidd, come into the blog and work with my kids. And they, she taught them so much more about that book than I ever could. She taught them about the themes, where the characters came from. She talked about her childhood, about the symbols, about how important the moon was when she was growing up. I mean, it was just amazing stuff that nowhere, no way could I have ever shared that with them. One of my journalism students was mentored, writing her story by a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist from the Washington Post, who I just happened to meet on the beach one day. Literally, just ran into him, started talking to him. I said, hey, you know, I'm looking for mentors all the time. Can you come in and mentor one of my kids? And she learned so much more from him. And I'm a journalism major. She learned so much more from him than she could have from me. And my class did too, because it was all transparent. So how do we need to change how we look at what our role in the classroom is when we have access to all of these people and all of these things? And finally, how do we define literacy in a place where, you know, we not only know how to read and write, but edit and create and publish? Now, there's a lot of challenges here. Obviously, we were talking about the fear issue a little bit at dinner yesterday. MySpace would be the 12th biggest country in the world right now, believe it or not. It's huge. And it's very scary to people. Should I show you? Have you been? Is there anyone who hasn't been to a MySpace site? What? How many of you have been to a MySpace site? So I probably don't need to show this, but I'll probably have to log in to see it anyway. But no? Okay. So this is kind of typical. Okay, so that's kind of scary for people, for parents, when they go and see that, right? This is a girl in New Jersey. I don't know who she is. She says she's 16. Her name is Diana. If we worked hard enough, we could probably figure out quite a bit about her. But the point of this is that kids are networking and doing things online that, in very transparent ways, that they never used to, obviously, and that scares us. It scares us a lot. There is a great, if you're interested in this whole phenomenon, which I think, again, I would suggest you might want to be, there's a great article online by a woman named Dana Boyd and a guy by the name of Henry Jenkins that kind of deconstructs why kids are doing this, why this is so enticing to them. And they talk about the fact that when I was growing up, at least, and probably some of you who are kind of my age, but, you know, when I was a kid, my mom said, basically, or if I said, you know, I'm going to go down the park, I'm going to ride down the park and hang out with my friends and, you know, we're going to whatever, she'd say, okay, just be home by dark. You know, no big deal. I have a 6 and 8 year old. I can't imagine ever saying that to them these days. Now, I live in probably one of the safest parts of the world, literally. Hunterdon County in New Jersey is the safest county in New Jersey. My township where I live is the safest township in Hunterdon County. I mean, but still, they're, you know, it's, they got a 20 yard walk to the end of the driveway and we're down there with them every morning for waiting for the bus, you know. So where are kids supposed to do this now? Where are kids supposed to socialize? Where are they supposed to get that whole kind of adolescent thing that kids do, that we all did, right? This probably isn't too far removed from some of the things that we did. And I can tell you just by looking at some of the girls who walked down to high school on a warm spring day, you know, where I used to teach, that, you know, they're acting this stuff out in real life as well. But, you know, this probably isn't, but the difference is it's now up there for everyone to see. It's a whole different kind of feel to it and a whole different kind of fear that goes along with it as well. And I would say, I mean, I do this in some of my other workshops, but I could show you right now a Coors Light ad that looks exactly like this page. And I would ask you, are you surprised by this? Really? Are you really surprised by the way that girls are objectifying themselves and even guys are objectifying themselves at MySpace? This is a culture that objectifies men and women, basically. Right? But we just don't want to have that conversation. We don't want to kind of admit that. But go look at the magazine rack anywhere around you. Look at the covers. Really look at the covers of magazines. I have an 8-year-old daughter. You know, every time we're watching TV, every time we're walking somewhere, and there's a picture, she's got a picture, she really likes Hillary Duff, right? Hillary Duff poster. I said, Tess, she's not real. You understand that, right? She's like, what do you mean?
Tess, look at her skin. There is not one mark on her whole body. Nowhere. She is not real. Understand that. What you are looking at is a fake. Right? This isn't the way real people look. But they are subjected to millions of images like this. Millions of images like this. Bulletin boards. I mean, highway signs. Everywhere you look. I mean, I tell you, my biggest challenge in life is getting her through. Without question. Without question. You know? And I mean, it's just, that is the main job of my life right now, is trying to make sure that she understands, that she has the context to grow up in a world that basically does this to all girls, expects them to do this, expects them to take sexy pictures of themselves, and now, guess what? They can be the advertisements. They can be the movies. They can be all that stuff that they see. Why wouldn't they do this? So this is much more than just MySpace. This is a whole cultural thing. And we are really getting this up in our face now, and we're going, oh, this is terrible, this is terrible. But you know what? It's about time we start having these conversations and start seeing this, because this is what we're doing to our kids, I think. Just my opinion again. But, and it's not just girls, you know, I mean, it's guys too. You look at some of the guys here, and if you go to, just real fast, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but she's got 790 friends in her list here. And somewhere in here we can see all of them, but I'm sure if we just go down here, we'll see some of the guys who are scantily clad and, you know, doing all sorts of things over here. And I mean, they're being all macho and stuff. So, I mean, yeah, we're really, we don't like what we're seeing here, obviously. It's not something that we particularly are comfortable with, but this is something we really have to deal with. And we really have to, we should teach MySpace, without question. We should be teaching MySpace in our schools. And yet we're blocking it, you know? And believe me, on that level, I don't really have that much of a problem with blocking MySpace. But we should be bringing in pictures of MySpace on our video iPods and plugging them into the TVs and putting them up there and saying, okay, now look, let's look at what you're really seeing here and what these people are really doing and how to do this. If you're going to do this, do it well. Do it in ways that you can maybe learn something, right? And the other thing is, 67% of people on MySpace are adults. And they're not behaving much more appropriately than the kids are, either. You know? So there's a lot of issues about that. But change is another one. I don't know if you, whether you like Al Gore or not, I kind of like what he's been saying lately. You know, change really is inconvenient. This whole thing with global warming, I mean, we're pretty much toast. Bad metaphor, I know. But if we don't change, if you believe that stuff, I happen to. If you believe that stuff, if we don't change, I have a push mower now, a reel mower, no engine. I'm out there twice a week. My wife writes environmental books, so I pretty much don't have a choice. But it is inconvenient, right? We don't want to, do I have to do that? Do I have to drive this one-way car? Do I have to recycle all this stuff? Right? Do I have to use the same water bottle for a week? She checks, by the way. She'll check to make sure I have the same water bottle. She can cite statistics about water bottles that would make your stomach turn. But it's the same thing here. It's the same, I think, the same parallel to what's happening in the classroom. Change is really inconvenient right now. There are all sorts of other things going on. You know, we have to pass the test. We have to do all these things to get through. But the world is changing. It's changing whether we want it to or not. And the inconvenient truth about education is that 28% of our kids in 2000 think schoolwork is meaningful. And 21% think courses are interesting, and 39% think school will be important later in life. And that's 2000. You can see the trend lines. That's inconvenient, isn't it? We better start. We better start thinking about how to change that stuff. 30% of ninth graders don't graduate high school in 4 years. That's a recent statistic just came out last week from the New York Times. And only 27% of adults over 25 have a college degree. Do you realize that? That's it. In this country, 27% of adults have a college degree. Now, does that mean that we have to have a college degree, that we have to graduate high school? Well, ask Bill Gates, no. Right? It doesn't mean that. But it tells you something. Right? We are pretty much at a crisis here about what's going on. Control is a problem, lack thereof, and our responses are to block it, to filter it, to take it away, right? To restrict it. We take their cell phones away. We tell them they can't go to Wikipedia in school. There are districts in Texas that are blocking every page on the internet that have the words my and space on them. Not MySpace. My space.
You might as well take it down. We take the tools they use out of their hands, and the result is schools are looking less and less like what the real world looks like to kids. And I really think we're in serious danger of becoming really irrelevant, especially when there are so many more options out there now that kids can take. You know, online courses, and the superintendent of schools in Ohio has lost, she reported last month, they've lost 100,000 public school kids now. 100,000 kids have left the system because there are alternatives. There are places they can go, and because they don't feel like they're getting the education that they want in those places. So I just want to leave you with this. I had a chance to speak with about 50 superintendents in Western New York a couple weeks ago. And I posted on my blog that I was going to do this, and I got a ton of responses from people that I thought were really interesting. But the one that I thought was most interesting was this one from Chris Lehman, the guy who I was talking to last night on Skype, actually. And I just want to read this to you because I think, you know, this is, he, by the way, is implementing Web 2.0 tools into his school, into the very fiber of his school, this new school that he's starting in Philadelphia. So there's a lot of pressure on him, and we remind him of this all the time. You better make this work, Chris, or you're going to be in trouble. But he is a very smart, very forward-thinking person. He basically says, you know, tell them that our schools have to change or die. Tell them there are more and more people arguing in the classroom the very thing that we spent our professional career in love with is really obsolete. Tell them that those people are right unless we learn to change. Tell them that our kids have already changed. Tell them that our kids need us to teach even more now. Our kids have more access to more varied level of information than ever before in human history, and our kids need us to teach them how to navigate that space more than ever. Tell them that locking out the sites and tools of this new world our kids live in will render us irrelevant and useless when our students need us most. Tell them that this new world means that teaching skills, cognitive and metacognitive, is now more important than memorizing content. Tell them that multiple choice tests can't possibly measure the new skills our kids must master. Tell them that our students can be content producers now as much as content consumers. Tell them that many of our students know how to reach a larger audience more quickly than any school district memo could ever hope to. Tell them that our students need our help to make them understand how powerful that is. Tell them that we have the opportunity to use these tools to extend our reach far beyond our school walls, far past the hours of the school day. Tell them we can build a 24/7, 365 school if we embrace the technologies our students are already using. Tell them there are too many teachers using these tools already to think that our schools won't be affected. Tell them it's unfair and unsustainable to think that the lone teacher using Yahoo groups and Hotmail accounts without explicit school support can make enough difference to create institutional change. Tell them that the change has to come from our schools using the tools as a part of their mission and a part of their infrastructure. Tell them that our students are already telling new stories. And tell them that it's time for our schools to do so as well. Tell them that this matters more than they are really willing to admit. I think that's a pretty powerful response from someone who is an educational leader and who is being charged, basically, with really rethinking what schools are about. Chris Lehman. If I can give it to you, but if you look up his name, Chris, L-E-H-M-A-N-N, his blog is called Practical Theory. So I guess the question, going back to Kyle MacDonald, kind of is, you know, what are you willing to trade? What's your one red paperclip that you're willing to take out of your classroom and that you're willing to see maybe what you can trade it up for in terms of using some of these technologies, some of these ideas, some of the imagination that you can bring to it? You know, what's one way that you can move forward? And in doing so, kind of keep trading up. Because I think that's the only way we get to where we really need to go, which is a place where people understand the powers of the connections that we have right now. There's serious, serious work to be done, obviously, I think. And it's coming at us so quickly. Even I am overwhelmed by it. And I spend way too much of my time trying to figure this out, trying to keep track of it. But I think that's your question. You know, what will you take back to your schools? And what will you trade about your practice?
The Speaking of History podcast is produced by Eric Langhorst in Liberty, Missouri, under a Creative Commons license. Visit the website for show notes and links to material in the podcast at www.speakingofhistory.blogspot.com. The podcast is also available on iTunes. Please email all comments and questions to speakingofhistory@gmail.com. Background music for the intro is Z from James Underberg from PodSafe Audio. Thanks for listening.